People in the audience, including Michelle, Anton, Songsik, and Shogun. So here's the outline of my talk. First, I will give you some background on the problem and why we are looking for this weird thing called quantum spin liquid, and why looking for quantum spin liquid on a Kagome lattice is a good idea. And then I will try to drag you through a toy problem, including only two spinons, to gain some intuition. And then based on these intuitions, we'll build a many-body model of spinons, which we will apply on the Kagome lattice. And after that, we will show that the ground state of this particular model is generically a Z2 spin liquid. And I will show you some properties, some simple properties of Z2 spin liquid. And I will finish my talk by pointing to some possible future directions. So background. We know that the ordinary magnetic phases we encounter every day, including so-called classical paramagnetic phase, in this phase, magnetic dipoles, they just the fluctuation relatively independent of each other. This we can understand as the gaseous form of a spin phase. And also, in the low temperature, the magnetic moments depends on whether they want to align with each other or anti-align with each other. They tend to order into classical long-range order. This is like a solid form of spin order. So what else is out there? It's just some natural human curiosity. Can we have, because we have this gas phase and we have this solid phase, can we have some liquid phase just like water, you know, between the gas and solid of H2O. So quantum spin liquid is one possibility that can realize this liquid form. And in such a state, it's a mystery state, right? There's no universal rigorous definition of what quantum spin liquid is, but there are several general features that people can agree upon. The first one is that the average in this state of the magnetic dipole is just zero. And but this state is different from the spin gas phase, which is classical paramagnet, in that it's a coherent quantum state with no broken symmetry, and thus the name liquid. And a canonical example of such a spin liquid phase is provided by the famous resonant wavelength bound state, in which it's a superposition. You can understand such a state as roughly a superposition of states with maximum number of singlets. One of the such so-called state is drawn over here, which on square lattice, every spin is coupled into a nearest neighbor singlet. And if you need some additional motivation, I can throw some big words toward you, and namely, you know, quantum spin liquid is predicted to have topological order, and it hosts fractionalized excitations. And it can, of course, if I want to hype this one even up, I can say, you know, you can apply this to the future topological quantum computers. And also, there are many theoretical proposals saying possibly the spin liquid phase is connected to the high temperature superconductivity. But I will stop right there because I will soon wander into something that I don't really understand before I say something terribly wrong. Now, I think everybody, provided everybody is fired up about looking for a quantum spin liquid, so how do we do that? So one way of doing this is that we are trying to melt, in order to find a liquid, we melt the solid, right? What is solid? It's long-range magnetic order. And so let's consider as simple as a single bond, two spins, two spin one half, right? So on this system, it's apparent that the quantum spin liquid, in this case, is just a singlet, right? Has a much better energy than the classical order, which you have two spins pointing different directions, right? But life is not as simple as a single bond. On a connected lattice, melting the solid is not as easy. For example, on a square lattice, one spin actually has four neighbors. In a quantum spin liquid state, if this spin can only couple to one of its neighbors into a singular state, but in a semi-classical state, the all four bonds, the energy can be lowered to a certain degree in this collinear anti-alignment of spins. So if we do a quick and dirty estimation of what energy is without considering any fluctuation effects, namely, I'm not talking about spin waves and movements of the dimers and so on, the energy of the semi-classical state is much better per site than the energy of the a quantum spin liquid state with singlet, right? So I'm sorry, I need to say something more about this. But this quick and dirty estimation tells us something. We have two ways of raising the energy of the spin solid in contrast to a spin liquid state. One way is that we increase the energy of the semi-classical state of each bond, right? Now we have this spin perfectly anti-aligned with each other. Suppose we have a lattice structure that's not the best case scenario, right? And the second way is that we reduce the number of nearest neighbors, right? So both factors comes in the case of the Kagome lattice. Namely, the first factor comes in because we have triangles, right? So we know that on a triangle, three classical spins tend to form this 120 degrees from each other. So the energy per bond in this case is not minus 0.25J, but minus 0.125J as a factor two of reduction of the magnitude, right? And also, the coordination number of this lattice is relatively low, it's still 4. So if we still do our quick and dirty estimation, you see that the quantum state has actually has a better energy than the classical state. So this tells us in a very simple, intuitive way, but maybe cannot withhold rigorous integration, that the Kagome lattice is a good place to look for quantum spin liquid state. And also, Kagome lattice is just not, until recently, it's just some theoretical string, right? But recently, several Kagome compounds has been synthesized, and most famous one of them is so-called Herbert Smithii. The chemical formula is displayed in the bottom. On the left, you see a crystal form of the Herbert Smithii. On the right, you see the crystal structure. It's actually, you have Kagome layers of copper ions, which carry spin 1/2, and they are separated by the triangular layers of zinc ions, which are displayed as a yellow ball over there. So this material represents by far the best realization of spin 1/2 antiferromagnetic model on Kagome lattice. And there have been a ton of experimental work done on this. I just mentioned a few here. Magnetic susceptibility measurement by Joe Helton et al. Shows no sign of long range order, right? And also, oxygen 17 NMR, the night shift measurement, shows no sign of long range order either. And the night shift value tends to some finite value, seems to indicate the ground state seems to be gapless. And there has been a range of sophisticated numerical techniques applied on this model, including series expansion and the MIRA. And the ground state they selected. And exactly the calculation showed the ground state in a singlet with a very small spin gap. And recently, it has been a large amount of activity using DMR, two-dimensional DMRG calculation, shows ground state as Z2 liquid, and provides the first positive evidence the ground state is Z2 liquid, showing that the entanglement entropy is log 2 by this two later work. So the ground state candidates, including these ones and the later two are achieved by this so-called parton construction of your spins, where you rewrite your spin into either two fermions or two bosons, and you solve your mean field theory. and do a Gauss-Weyler projection, and you can get these candidates. And they to liquid, they get using this kind of approach tends to become a large variety, right? Sometimes accounts in number of 20, you have 20 different type of Z2-liquid, or sometimes comes into number of 8, you have 8 different type of Z2-liquid. Sometimes it's hard to distinguish which one is the one found by DMRG. So now I hope I get you, gave you the idea that this problem is an important problem. They have a lot of activity on it. Now I start to introduce you our approach. So we basically by rewrite the Hamiltonian in this form, and we show that the exchange Hamiltonian can be treated as a summation of the Hamiltonian of each triangle, right? And the Hamiltonian of each triangle, the energy of each triangle can be minimized if we combine two spins out of three spins into a singlet, so that the total spin of that triangle is spin 1/2. So then if we say, let's try to do this as best as possible, then we have so-called dimer covering state of Kolmogorov-Milanov. Pretty soon we discover that we cannot do this to the perfect, right? So there are some triangles, indeed they have dimer on them, they are so-called vacuum triangles, have the minimum energy possible, right? But there are a quarter number of triangles that you cannot, by geometrical constraint, they cannot be covered by singlet. They don't have a definite total spin. So those triangles are what we call defect triangles, and those are the source of the quantum dynamics. So, in order to understand their properties, let's try to study them one at a time, right? So many body model, many body problems hard, one body problem is simple. So how do we do it? We introduce a so-called Husimi cactus. It's a caddy tree of corner sharing triangles. It has the same local geometry as Kagome, but without the loops. And we can isolate one defect triangle at the center of the cactus and study the quantum mechanics of it, right? So we do it by mapping out the Hilbert space of this particular state by applying Hamiltonian repeatedly to the state. We see that the defect triangle state actually breaks into two defects connecting by a long range singlet. I want to emphasize that because although these two defects are connected by a long range singlet, right? They are still defects in the near, they are still defects in the dimer covering state with nearest neighbor singlet, right? So they are not connected by a nearest neighbor singlet, they are connected by a long range singlet. So we actually, we can see that they can move relatively free of each other.
Time. I was confused, if you go back two slides about the defect triangle on the Kagome compared to the other triangles, and I didn't really see what was different about it, because every spin on the defect triangle is involved in a singlet somewhere.
Yes, but if you just say what's the total spin of the defect triangle, it does not have a definite value, right?
But isn't that also true of the vacuum triangle? Because, the three spins there are all tied up in singlets.
Yes, for the vacuum triangle, the total spin of the vacuum triangle is 1/2, right? Because two spins are coupled in a singlet on the vacuum triangle, and the remaining, I mean, if you just...
But the like the one that you've drawn I think I'm missing something very simple. The one that you've drawn the arrow to, you've got the two on the side are forming a singlet, and then the third one is forming a singlet with one of its neighbors on a different triangle.
Yes, but if you we are just asking what's the question of what's the total spin of that particular.
Sorry.
So if you just I agree that the total spin of the whole system is zero, right? Because you only have singlets. But if you just ask what's the total spin of a defect triangle, you cannot determine that. Because if you just trace out the rest part of your system, it will become the wave function, I mean, the density matrix of that defect triangle will become a, it's not a pure state, right? It will become a mixed state. You cannot determine the total spin of that defect triangle. I mean, I'm sure there is there must be some more intuitive way of saying this, but I don't have it right now. Sorry. So these spin-ons are actually just the point. You can treat them as spin 1/2 point-like defects within the background of nearest neighbor singlet, and those are our subjects to study. So, okay. So I didn't mention that we are taking a variational approach, and now we have two. In our low energy basis, we have two type of states, right? One type of states is that every spin is coupled into nearest neighbor singlet. We have dimer covering state. We also have this spin-down states where each defect triangle is broken into two spin-downs. Actually, the vacuum the remaining nearest neighbor singlets, they exert constraint on the motion of spin-downs. In the case of the cactus, the spin-downs can only move on three one-dimensional chains connected by the center triangle, highlighted here. So this constraint will later become very important in our many-body model. And because we have this T-junction, we have two spin-downs, we can just exchange the two spin-downs and study their quantum statistics, right, in this fashion. So in order to do that, we recall that the singlet is not just a directionless thing, right? So the singlet have wave function, have a psi ambiguity, that these two wave functions represent the same state, but the sign is different, right? So now we presume to exchange the two spin-downs in the following fashion. If we compare the initial state and final state, we see the wave function acquire a negative sign. This gave us the first indication that the spin-downs are fermions. And we are able to calculate the ground state wave function on a cactus of two spin-downs in total S equal to zero or total S equal to one channel. We see that total S equal to zero channel, the wave function is symmetric in spin-down coordinates. And total S equal to one channel, the wave function is anti-symmetric in the spin-down coordinates. So that's the confirmation that the spin-downs are fermions. So at this level, we can say, you know, on the level of two spin-down problem, we can study what's the neutron cross section. So we have one neutron coming in, and it excites two spin-downs, and they move relatively free of each other. And on the left is our calculation for the radius of cactus with n equal to 5. On the left is the neutron scattering measurement of MIT group. We see that the two pictures agree qualitatively quite well. So here is my summary slides for the problem, our toy problem of two spin-downs. It demonstrates several important points. Let me just reiterate them here. The spin-downs are fermions, and they tend to decolocalize and gain kinetic energy, and they can lower their potential energy by forming nearest neighbor singlets, and their motion is strongly constrained by the singlet, by the remaining background singlets. So now we start to study what's the many-body model, because we have finite fraction of defect triangles on the Kagome, right? So in order to do that, we need to recall a representation first invented by the Zinn and Elza of any dimer covering state on Kagome. So we have a one-to-one mapping from any dimer covering state on Kagome from dimer covering to the arrow configuration, right? So for any vacuum triangle, we drew two arrows in and one arrow out, you know, from, and for any defect triangle, we drew three arrows out. So on the dimer covering configuration on the left becomes arrow configuration on the right. And we can extend this error representation by including the error configuration of one in and two out, which representing a spin-up, right? So because this is a one-to-one mapping, right? So we can forget about the fact that we have the Kagome lattice and just deal with the honeycomb lattice. And in this case, our spin-ups just live on the sides of the honeycomb lattice. And when it moves, you see that the constraint of the background singlets on the spin-up motion can be captured in a concise statement that the spin-up only move along the direction of the arrows. So once we know that, we can write down our many-body model. It's a long equation. And I just highlight that we have one spin-up per unit cell on the honeycomb lattice. This is just coming from the counting of we have one defect triangle per four triangles. And the arrows are represented in this case by pseudo spin one half. They are different from the original spin one half, right? And the SZ equal to plus minus one half is the arrow pointing from sublattice A to sublattice B. Honeycomb is bipartite, so we can have this arrow direction. It's not ambiguous. So the weird S plus operator in between the two fermion operators there capture the fact that the spin-on only move along the direction of the arrows. So our model have a Gauss's law because we know that the arrow configuration determines the number of spin-ons on the site, right? So if we have a defect triangle on the site, it's like two spin-ons. That's N equal to two. And if we have two arrow out and one arrow in, that's one spin-on. You have for two arrow in and one arrow out, that's zero spin-on, right? So that's captured by the equation over there. And we have emergent compact U1 gauge symmetry. We can just do a full-fledged pass integral formalism. The Lagrangian looks like this. So you don't have to read through the super equation. And you just need to trust more words that the following gauge, the theory is invariant under the following gauge transformation. And physically, the U1 gauge symmetry is just a concise way of capturing the constraint of background singlets on the motion of spin-ons, right? So that's the take-home message I want you to have. And now we can pursue, because we have this model, we can play with the parameters. We can study U equal to zero, study the spectrum of spin-ons will be determined by the gauge flux through each plaquette. We can, in the zero flux phase, we have the particle hopping on the honeycomb lattice. And at one quarter fading, you have an extended Fermi surface. In the pi flux, we have four bands, and the low energy excitations are actually Dirac fermions. And I just want to mention that we have this nice correspondence to the previous proposal of algebraic spin liquid state. But our band structure is exactly the same as their band structure minus the flat band, low energy flat band. So when we have strong attraction, which I believe we have, which naturally have the fermions tend to pair into Cooper pairs, we have the charge two Higgs phase that's demonstrated by these papers to be a Z2 liquid. And the spin gap tends to be large for zero flux phase. Right, because we have extended Fermi surface, we have strong attraction, finite density state gave you a large spin gap. And the spin gap tends to be small for pi flux phase because you have Dirac point and that's zero density of state. So on this basis, we believe the pi flux phase and the pi flux phase also have a smaller mean field energy is the ground state. And we have then we have fermionic deconfined fermionic spin-ons, which are just Bogoliubov quasi-particles. We have Weissons, which are just vertices, and they have mutual semionic statistics. If we take one Weisson, one spin-on around one Weisson, you just pick up minor sign. That's just the Abraham Born effect, I think. So. We also calculate the lower edge of two spin-on continue. And since I'm running out of time, I'm going to skip the last part and come right to the conclusion that here is my conclusion. And here's the future directions. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Zihao. We have time for questions and comments. If there are any. Yes, Radu, please. I'll give you the microphone.
Thank you. When you showed the comparison with the neutron scattering data, was that a slice at fixed energy or energy integrated?
It's sliced at fixed energy, I believe.
So yeah. How does that relate to the image that you showed? You just flick through here now, recently now, with the edge of the two spin on continuum. Can you go back to that?
Oh, the edge of two spin on continuum is just the lower edge, right?
Yeah. So what sort of energy range would have been integrated?
So that one will be just at the very lower edge, at very low energy spin on excitations. And the material is more complicated, of course, right? So you're in between Kagome layers, you are supposed to only have zinc ions, but instead you don't. You have some coppers over there as well, right? So that can mess up the spin gap, for example.
But your calculation was basically just the lowest energy part of this.
Yes, lower energy run. And in the future, we decide to, we can do the full dynamical susceptibility.
I actually had a related question. When you, the picture, theoretical picture you compared with that was for the cactus, but how do you define K on the cactus?
Oh, on the cactus, we just do an average. We don't have any. Strictly speaking, it's not a struct. It's just a form factor. It's not a structure factor. So we can on the cactus, because you can go a certain radius of the cactus. Without running into contradiction, on the cactus within a certain radius, the geometry is the same, right? Once you have loop, you are screwed. But if you don't have loop, you are okay. So we can, what we did is that we calculate the structure factor as an increasing radius. We see that before you run into that problem, the shape of the structure factor is the form factor, is already stabilized.
Further questions or comments? I'll follow up on the comparison to the neutron scattering. The neutron scattering was diffuse, and your calculation was diffuse, but the neutron scattering was more diffuse, right? And so do you attribute any particular significance to that relative to your calculation?
I actually don't have a good answer for that. So we can discuss later, but I don't have a really short good answer for that. Yeah.
Okay, further questions or comments? Well, if not, let's thank Zihao for a very nice talk.